VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, and welcome to Wine Times, brought to you in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. My name is Will Lyons, the Sunday Times wine columnist and vice president of the Sunday Times Wine Club. I'm very excited to bring you a special bonus episode of the podcast recorded at the Daffodil Restaurant in Cheltenham as part of the Cheltenham Literary Festival celebrations. And I'm joined by a fantastic guest, Alan Johnson. Alan spent many years at the height of the British government serving in Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's cabinets. Since then, he's been a mainstay in political discussion and latterly has turned his hand to writing thriller novels. I'm delighted to say that Alan Johnson joins me now on the show.
Brilliant. Thank you for coming. You didn't get the memo about dressing like an expert for the Antiques Roadshow.
No, but I see a few other guests are dressed down. I've just come straight from interviewing Wes Streeting at the festival, so I didn't have time to put on my... You look like Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well, I know, I've gone over the top. I always go over the top. I'm sorry. But how are you enjoying Cheltenham? I mean, I have to say, it's my first time. It's incredible, isn't it? How are you enjoying it?
You've never been to Cheltenham before?
Never been to Cheltenham History Festival.
I love Cheltenham. Cheltenham is
Hopefully this will be the beginning of a new relationship.
Yeah, I hope so. Cheltenham is the finest book festival, finest literary festival in the country. Me and... my wife, Carolyn, and I have been coming here for 10 years.
Wow.
And it is like... you know, coming away and meeting old friends. They look after you as an author. They look after you as an interviewer. I'm here interviewing mainly this time. And you have events like this. I mean, what a fabulous... It was difficult coming down those stairs after five glasses of fine wines, Will.
I know. We could start there. I've read that you have a relationship with wine. How did that all start?
A relationship with wine, Well, I think, you know, I'm of a generation in this country where we didn't drink wine very much, particularly working class background. I think probably people from middle class background very rarely touched wine. And, you know, our approach to cuisine wasn't brilliant. Yeah. So I drank mainly beer. When wine started to take off in the 80s and 90s, in the sense it was suddenly available on supermarket shelves.
Yeah.
By then, I'd become a trade union official. And you went to dinners and you went to, you know, great TUC events, and there was wine there. I didn't know what I was drinking. I wasn't, you know, I'm not a wine connoisseur. And my relationship with wine wasn't profound, but I liked it.
Yeah.
And I thought, actually, in the end, you know, you start off preferring a pint rather than a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And gradually that changed. And the wine took predominance.
But it's nice that you actually like to drink. I mean, we were talking earlier about the 60s and 70s, which was steeped. This country was steeped in a drinking culture, was that?
Every meeting you had, I was a trade union official. When you did a deal with management, and I was dealing with British Telecoms or the post office, the drinks cupboard would be open and out would come the whiskey and the vodka and not often wine, actually. Drink was everywhere. I mean, hospitals used to come round. Gordon Brown went into hospital because he had an eye injury playing rugby when he was 19. And he told me when I was health secretary about when he was in hospital, and round came the nurse at 9 o'clock every night with a trolley full of alcohol to give patient. it was part of the culture.
Yeah, I think there's a book in this because, You know, we read in the Times that, you know, in France they're having to grub up vineyards because people aren't drinking enough. And I just think we've found other ways to be less productive, which essentially is being on the internet and on our mobile phones. But in the old days, it was, I mean, you talk about the great ministers of the past, people like Roy Jenkins, that they knew how to enjoy themselves.
Well, you mentioned Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
I mean, Roy Jenkins wrote several great biographies of Gladstone, of Asquith, and of Churchill. And his biography of Churchill lists Churchill's alcohol consumption through the Second World, daily alcohol consumption.
Thank you.
When he was leading this country through the Second World War. It's an advertisement for getting drunk every day, actually, because he did fine on it. But, you know, he would start the day, a bottle of champagne to Churchill, as you were mentioning early on, caught it by lunchtime was fine, but then it was the red wine, it was the brandy, it was in everything. He was a huge consumer of alcohol.
Well, I think he drank for energy. So he drank champagne, as you said. And Paul Roger always say that in his lifetime, he drank 42,000 bottles of Paul Roger. And he'd drink a bit like another sort of controversial conservative prime minister, Margaret Thatcher. He drank a lot of Scotch whiskey and he drank brandy. But if you read the diaries of Field Marshal Allenbrooke during the Second World War, I mean, he's so exasperated with Churchill.
Secretary, yeah.
And they went to Moscow where they had a meeting with Stalin. And even then, Churchill was done for because the toast just went on and on. And they didn't start work till 4 o'clock in the morning. But by which time, the two leaders of Russia and, you know, the Allied forces were completely...
But it was, you know, society's attitude to alcohol then was different. There was a famous Labour deputy prime minister called George Brown.
Yes.
He was a deputy to Harold Wilson in the 60s. And George Brown was absolutely notorious for his consumption of strong alcohol. And the story that I'm told is true is he went to a dinner one night in a hotel in Westminster, and it was a dinner dance. And as usual, he consumed too much alcohol. And afterwards, there was a ball, and he staggered out onto the dance floor, went up to someone who he thought was a lady in red, and slurred, "Beautiful lady in red, will you accompany me for this waltz?" And this person said no for three reasons. Number one, you're drunk. Number two, this is not a waltz, it's the Uruguayan national anthem. And number three, I'm not a lady in red, I'm the Bishop of Montevideo. And, you know, most people who knew George Brown say that was probably true.
But going back to the early days, your other passion was music, wasn't it? And, of course, music as well lends itself to sort of an appreciation of the finer things in life.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah, but when I was listening to music and was mad about the Beatles and playing in two bands in the in my teens, I wasn't drinking much. You'd get a pint and, you know, that would be on your amplifier. But, no, it wasn't part of my... if you want to get onto drugs and cannabis and all that, which I wasn't, by the way, that was probably more of the scene in the 60s rather than alcohol.
I think you're right about how the great democratization of wine. I mean, I'm 47, but I always think it came a bit later than we thought, because we always think it happened in the 80s. But I think it really happened with those sort of Dudley Moore adverts that he was doing them for Tesco, do you remember? And Tesco had a big push on wine. And I always think back to I grew up on a farm, and the chap who worked on the farm, Norman, he used to stop on the way home from work in the 70s and 80s and have a pint of beer at the Red Lion. And then when I started getting into wine at university, I'd go back home, and he'd go, your father says you're into wine. I drink that old Shiraz now, and Cabernet Sauvignon, and it has become a big part of life, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, I have to say, the people who introduced me to wine were the same people generally who introduced me to literature.
Yeah.
They were postmen. There wasn't many postwomen in my office when I was postman. But, you know, people would come up to me. It was almost like a secret society of people who liked W.H. Auden or read John Betjeman, or, you know, because you didn't walk in to the canteen in the sorting office holding the collected poems of T.S. Eliot under your arm, because you would be derided. But there was these people who, in fact, I put it this way, I worked with more people who were very literate in the sorting office than anywhere else, and I worked in Parliament for 20 years. So you can... But in the same way, I remember Les Hewitt, who was a postman from South East London. When I was on the executive of the union, he came to me and said, Alan, gave me two bottles of red wine for my birthday. My birthday almost always corresponded with our annual conference. And Les said, look, I've never seen you drinking red wine. Les loved wine. He used to say, a meal without wine is like a day without sunshine.
Yeah, that's nice.
And he gave me these two bottles of red wine. I have to say, I was a young executive council member and he told me they were an aphrodisiac. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. But he gave me these two lovely bottles of red wine and said, see what you think of them. Yeah. And there was another postman called Mike Hogan who loved Gewürztraminer and loved the Alsace wines.
Yeah.
And introduced me to those. So, you know, this idea that it was only very cultured people from the middle and upper classes that enjoyed wine. There were people who were wine aficionados, even in the sorting offices I worked in.
Did you get lots of Christmas tips as a postman? I imagine you got a few bottles. Well, from the...
I got loads of Christmas tips, yeah, because I was a very good postman and was very obsequious to my customers. In fact, the ones who didn't give you a tip, you put a black mark and thought, right, well... No, I very generous, because I was a kind of rural post, Littleworth Common, not far from where you were born in Berkshire.
Yeah.
And there were 150 calls, and you went round, you were Postman Pat in a red van, and, you know, if someone wanted coal delivered from Burnham, this was Burnham in Buckinghamshire, you would go to FW Clears and get them a sack of coal and deliver it. Mrs. Rayner down at Hickenham Farm, her eggs had to be distributed to all kinds of people. Well, the postman would do it. No one would deliver their newspapers because it was too far out. It was too rural. So the postman had me and my two colleagues, because we did it on a rotation, we had a big pile of newspapers that we would pick up in Burnham and deliver. You know, we were kind of part of the community service. And Christmas time, we got our rewards.
Absolutely. Well, I just noticed we don't have a glass, actually. So we had some delicious wine tonight. I think we can all agree with that. Did you have a favourite? I think you liked the Le Coif from Bordeaux.
I did, yeah.
Pour ourselves a glass of that.
I've got a glass of water as well.
Beforehand. I thought that we should do that. We're in southwest France. Bordeaux is it's the world's largest fine wine region. It's known for red wine. We've been drinking it in this country for centuries. I think if you look at Edward II's, the records of his marriage in the 14th century, the 1382, he ordered the equivalent of 2 million bottles of Bordeaux for his wedding. And, of course, when Eleanor of Aquitaine, she married Henry Plantagenet, for 300 years, the whole of southwest France was under the control of the English crown. The Bordelais loved it because it was a very light touch. You had the French royal family in Paris, but their masters were over in London, and they just let them do what they wanted to do. People made lots of money, so we've been importing this wine. And the three major cities were, of course, Bristol, London, and Edinburgh, because before trains or the motor car or aeroplanes, the way you got your wine to market was by sea. And Bordeaux sits on the Atlantic, on the Gironde.
This is the history we should have learnt at school. We sat there through so many boring lessons.
How we'd be drinking and drinking. Well, yes, I mean, I could go on. Yeah. There was a wine bar. Aubryon, the most famous estate in Bordeaux, had a wine bar in London called the Pontac's Head, which burnt down in a great fire of London.
A wine bar?
It had a wine bar with the Pontac's Head. And the famous diarist, Samuel Pepys, he went there and he writes about it. But what we're drinking is, so as I was saying, we're thinking counterintuitively, thinking about our friend, well, my ex-editor, Andrew Neil, and we're drinking a Sauvignon Gris, and there's only a few hundred acres planted in Bordeaux.
I love this.
Yeah,
love
and this. It's what I like about it, I think Hugh Johnson, the club president, calls it a fridge door white, but it's just easy drinking, especially over Christmas, and it, unlike Sauvignon, it doesn't have that gooseberry, grassy character, it has more sort of melon, peachy, apple-y characters, and it just slips down well. But, Alan, let's go back to that really optimistic period. It was the spring, wasn't it, 97? I was at university, and New Labour sweep to power. And I always think that was, I'm quite old, sort of romantic, but that was like a cabinet full of rock stars, wasn't it? And I imagine it wasn't beer and sandwiches at those meetings. There was a lot of wine lovers there.
Maybe. I mean, we'd been out of power for 18 years, and... When Parliament reconvened, not on May the 1st, that was the election day, of course, we had a 177-seat majority.
Easy to
102 guess. Women coming in. Before then, out of 650 MPs, there were 26 women. Yeah. Suddenly, there were kind of 126 women. But through the swing doors came David Blunkett,
because
blind, with his guide dog, at the time was Lucy. And talk about a metaphor for the Labour Party, 18 years in opposition. Lucy led David to the opposition front bench. Yeah. On it, this is a true story. Simon Hoggart, who was the great political gallery writer for The Guardian, he said in any civilized society, they'd have let Lucy in early to pee on the government bench so she could find her way there. She'd never been anywhere near the government bench. So it was like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I'm trying to think, because we were talking upstairs, Will, about champagne corks popping or whatever. It kind of wasn't like that, because there was a real kind of feeling that now we've come back after 18 years, we can't blow this. We've got a huge majority, and there was a very serious view to it. People like Roy Jenkins, of course, who is a hero to me. I'm a huge admirer of Roy Jenkins. He was the epitome of the bon vivant and the wine connoisseur. But of course, he was no longer on our benches. In fact, when he left Parliament to go and be the president of the European Union, Roy, who famously couldn't pronounce his R's, came out as W's. It's absolutely true. He said to Parliament, what he meant to say was, I leave this place without rancor. The way it came out, Dennis Skinner said as an aside, caught by the Hansard writers, oh, we thought you were taking David Owen with you. But he was, so Roy, you know, the son of a Welsh miner.
Yeah.
He was an apple who fell a very long way from the tree.
Yeah.
And he says, there's a great biography of him by John Campbell, says that every day of his life, every day, he went out for a two-hour lunch with wine, rather like we just enjoyed here. I mean, that is amazing to do it as Home Secretary, as whatever.
It's almost unthinkable, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, almost unbelievable. He thought white wine was a kind of like Lucozade or lemonade or whatever. Red wine for him.
Yeah.
Famously claret.
As I mentioned earlier, who's to say he wasn't more productive? He made some very good decisions. He was a
Roy Jenkins probably made more great decisions as Home Secretary that affected more people's lives than anybody else.
Proper break. But I wonder if they do that in France, actually, if the politicians still...
I think there's more of an awareness now of the health. I mean, you were telling me earlier on that wine consumption is declining in France, particularly amongst the young.
Yeah.
It's declining here amongst the young as well.
Yeah, it is.
And I think people now realise those days where you just kind of spent the whole day in a haze of alcohol. Probably, they might have been okay for Churchill and Roy Jenkins, but for the rest of us, it was debilitating.
I mean, I'm a big cricket lover, and you think back of John Arlott, and you hear the stories there, and he would turn up at Lord's, at Test Match Special, wherever he was, and he would open up his briefcase, he'd have his notes, he'd have a corkscrew, he'd have a glass, and he'd have four bottles of claret, and they'd just drink all day. And actually, he was a beautiful commentator, but when you listen back on YouTube, it wasn't as insightful as it perhaps might be today. Perhaps I am romanticising a bit. And you served under them both, Tony and
Blair and Brown, yeah.
You'd always think of Tony just, you know, enjoying the I always think, the sort of finer things in life. And perhaps he'd like a Tuscan wine or something, like a Chianti or something. Was that the case? Or?
And Gordon.
And Gordon, you'd imagine, as a Presbyterian, quite dour. You'd think he would, he'd be on the water.
It was the other way round.
I know this
is for public consumption. And let me say to you, Gordon and Tony, I love you both, but I'm taking a view here. I spent a night with Gordon. God, that's a front page headline.
Yeah.
He invited me to his house. I was up in Fife when I was working pension secretary doing some stuff, and he invited me to stay with him. And Gordon was a different man when he was off the kind of front bench and away from the spotlight. And he opened up a really good, I would remember it, not just a bottle of champagne, a really good bottle of champagne. And we sat there, the two of us, drinking it until about 2 o'clock in the morning and talking and all that. He was very funny, you know, and he was a world away from this Calvinist kind of image. But he didn't enjoy the spotlight, and he didn't enjoy the kind of showbiz that politics has become. Tony loved it. You went somewhere with Tony and there were people asking for selfies and all that, and Tony would love it and smile. Gordon had this thing where, so when he took over from Tony in 2007, he appointed me as health secretary, Gordon. And on the Saturday, we went to Kingston Hospital. His first visit as a prime minister, my first visit anywhere as health secretary. It was very important. The first thing I noticed is it was taking us a long time on a Saturday morning to get from Downing Street to Kingston. That's because Gordon had dispensed with the outriders. I said to him, what are we doing sitting in traffic? He said, oh, I couldn't be bothered with all those, you know, all that cavalcade. So he got rid of them. The security services soon put them back again.
Yeah.
Because when you're a prime minister sitting in traffic, you're a sitting duck.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it took us a long time to get there. When we got there, Gordon went around to all the nurses and doctors, shaking their hands, saying, thanks for all you do. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for all you do. In the end, he shook hands with said, thanks for all you do. This person said, Gordon, I came with you from 10 Downing Street. You know, he was so incapable of relaxing in that situation. I mean, he's a fantastic brain.
Yeah.
But he didn't like the kind of showbiz side of it, and Tony did. And in the end, it kind of caught up with Gordon. He didn't like being on the receiving end of, you know, David Cameron's wit or whatever when he was at the dispatch box. And it was sad to see a great man and a great prime minister, by the way, in the end, kind of this wasn't really where he wanted to be.
Like I said earlier, I think we all sort of underestimated at the time that, you know, he was following a class act in Tony.
Well,
in terms of that
recent prime ministers and their, you know, approach to moral issues, Gordon was an important politician.
Well, perhaps not those two, but what about the sort of third senior figure in that new Labour wave, which was Peter Mandelson, a man who must like the finer things in life.
I can't ever remember Peter. I mean, he probably liked a glass of wine, but it would stop as a glass. I can't think. I mean, I've broken bread with Tony and with Gordon and with Peter, and I can't remember them being interested in wine. You know, for you, you're an expert, Will. And people, I guess, get a bit frightened of
talking to
experts about wine because it will kind of show their ignorance, my ignorance or whatever. But actually, you normally find some, oh, this is a really good claret or this is a really good, you know, Alsace white or whatever. And I don't remember any of that from Peter or Tony. And I wish I could think of someone who I could remember it from, but there's only Roy Jenkins, who I did know quite well. But
I've got one story that I was working at Just Ceridian Brooks when I left university, which is on St. James's Street. Very smart wine merchant. And working for the Conservative Party was the late, great, well, not great, perhaps, Alan Clark, MP for Kensington and Chelsea, who always charged for his interviews. I didn't realise this. And me and a chap called Giles Burke Gaffney were junior wine merchants. And the Daily Express had interviewed him. And they rang us up and they had £80. This was 98. £80 to spend on wine to give us a gift for him in lieu of his. And so I said, well, I tell you what, we've got this new Chilean wine. I think we should send that down. We sent him 12 bottles to his castle, Saltwood Castle in Kent.
Yeah.
Before, this is sort of pre-internet. So he rings up, 3 days later, he rings up. Giles picks up the phone and he goes, what is this? So Giles is like, well, who is this? And he goes, it's Alan Clark. Oh, he's like, oh, right. And I'm like, it's the Panama Estate. And he goes, what is it? Well, it's for that interview you gave for the Express. And he goes, take it away. I only drink Sassania Morichet, which is a very expensive Burgundy.
That sounds like Alan.
So we had to go down, take the case away, and deliver a bottle. I don't think he was happy with that.
That serves him right.
Now, since politics, you've turned your hand to wonderful biographies, autobiographies, volumes. But I particularly like your thriller writing. And I recommend this to anyone. If you just want an escapist, fast pace, I've really enjoyed it. In fact, it keeps me up. This one's set in, it touches on Crete. And what you're very good, I think, at doing, so I don't want to sound patronising, because you are a brilliant writer, in the way that Peter Mayle does it, is that you describe food and wine. There's always a scene, you know, with there's a great sort of outdoor restaurant owned by Dimitri. Yeah. And it takes you straight there to Crete, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you're there sitting there, and you're stuck at home on a horrible October evening. And suddenly you're thinking of the Mediterranean in the balmy weeks of summer. I mean, how did your relationship start with Crete and then thinking you would like to write like this, which I think is fantastic?
It's lovely you should mention that, Will. I mean, my memoirs sold very well. There were four of them, by the way.
Yeah.
In the end, I was sick of writing about myself. And I thought I'd better turn to fiction. And that's the second of a trilogy, so the third one's out next March. My wife and I, Caroline, who's up there at our table tonight, we went to Crete for the first time 7 or 8 years ago. And anyone who's been to Crete will know it is a wonderful, I mean, they don't think of themselves as Greek. They think of themselves as Cretans. Yeah. It's the biggest Greek island. And we ended up in this place in the middle of nowhere in Crete. And there's lots of nowhere to be in the middle of in Crete. And there was one restaurant run by a guy called Dimitri, but it was a run-down place. It didn't look any, it wasn't like this fabulous surroundings here. It was just some benches and, a kind of bit of a tall, a canvas top, and he would be in the kitchen at the back. And he would just produce, his name was Dimitri, he was a big guy. He would just produce whatever he wanted to produce that day. If you had kids, this wasn't a holiday camp, this was out in the middle of nowhere, but there were people either camping or whatever nearby. If you had kids, he would give you hamburger and chips. If you're an adult, there was no menu. He produced what he wanted to produce that day from whatever fresh produce he could get. We had a week of the most wonderful meals. One day it would be fresh fish cooked beautifully with the way that they do potatoes there. That's kind of the way the Cypriots do it as well. It's, amazing, covered in herbs. The next day you would have, there was no moussaka or anything like that. He didn't do the kind of traditional Greek stuff. He just cooked whatever he, and we had a really, really wonderful week there. And it gave us, then we went back to Crete, and eventually I got this idea about White Mountains in Crete, a beautiful area of Crete. And we happened to be driving through, and I'd already had one successful thriller out. My wife said, wouldn't it be funny if a minister was walking through these hills and disappeared? And that one of our ministers is missing was suddenly there. And the idea of it's set in a place called Agia Galeni on the south of Crete, looking out over the Libyan Sea. And I transferred Dimitri from his country place to a nice restaurant in Agia Galeni, producing this lovely stuff. But, anyone who loves reading, and this is a literary festival, love reading about food.
Yeah.
You can get people's gastric juices flowing just by reading about food and drink. And I was saying to you earlier, the Maigret novels of Georges Simenon. Georges Simenon got me drinking Calvados because Maigret, well, I blame him for it, because Maigret is always eating and always drinking. And Simenon is describing what he's eating and drinking. And as you're reading it, you think, I'd quite like to try that. And so, you can't get Calvados in many places.
It's an interesting coincidence because Tony Lathwaite, who founded the Sunday Times Wine Club with the great Harry Evans, he was inspired by Maigret. If you ask him about where does your love of wine come from, he said it all started with Maigret. And it's so evocative, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a big fan of the Bond books as well, which I've now admitted publicly. But they're all about food and drink. It's a lot of food in those early ones before I think you lost interest. You've had an enormously distinguished political career. And then you went, what inspired you to become a fiction thriller writer? Had it something that had been sort of burning
away? First of all, the electorate dispensed with our services, Will. Yeah. So, it's difficult to carry on with your ministerial career when you'd just been voted out of office in 2010. I always wanted to, this is where I'm so lucky compared to other writers, is that publishers wanted a book from me. What they wanted was the kind of bog standard political memoir. What I gave them was the story of my mother and my sister, two incredible women that protected me through, through my childhood. And so this boy just took off. It became really successful. And that brought me to Cheltenham, first of all. And then people were saying, well, it ends when I'm 18. Yeah. What happened next? And then came Please, Mr. Postman. And then you kind of had to finish it off. So the third one was Long and Winding Road, which is when I went into Parliament. All Beatles titles.
Yeah.
But for anyone of my generation, the Beatles changed the world, The Stones couldn't even change their chord formation, but the Beatles changed the world. And
as a few, the Stones fans will be speaking to me on the way out.
But this is the thing. You can't copyright a title. If you were to quote, from Eleanor Rigby, wearing the face that she kept in a jar by the door. I mean, what a line from Paul McCartney, age 21. But if you were to quote that in a book, you'd pay a fortune for the copyright. You can't copyright a title. So I could happily use their titles as I did for all the memoirs. So once I'd done that, sick of writing about myself, can I create this world that people will immerse themselves into for as long as it takes to read an 80,000 word novel? And that was the big, big challenge. I don't think I could have done it while I was still an MP. Certainly not while I was a minister. I didn't write anything while I was a minister. But that, you know, it's just a new world for me.
And you just sit down and just write. You don't plan it out.
I know where it starts and I know where it's going to finish.
Yeah.
I don't know much about in between. But then as you write, you find that every crime, I don't know a crime writer yet who has it all mapped out the way that Agatha Christie was supposed to. I mean, bless her. Did she do it that way? I'm not sure. That everything's plotted out from to the nth degree. It takes some of the energy out of the book.
Yeah.
You kind of know where... I knew a minister was going to go missing. I knew kind of what had happened to that minister. It's a him, so I knew what happened to him. The bits in between, as you start writing, you get a new idea. You go off in a different direction. Your characters actually do things that you weren't expecting them to do, and you're writing it, you know. It's your... I write longhand, so it's your... So I think you take some of that energy away if it's too much... Join up the dots, you know.
And do you write with music on in the background or with a glass of wine?
No, absolute silence. Yeah. Total silence. I can't do it. Some writers do with...
No, I know Ian Rankin does.
Yeah.
Just going back to the Beatles, how important do you think they are in terms of their music?
Change the world. Change the world. Read David Kynaston's latest. Kynaston's Tales of the New Jerusalem, which is probably his life's work. A bit like Robert Caro with the President Johnson in America. Mark Lewisham's doing the biography of the Beatles. I mean, his first one was 1,600 pages long and hadn't even got a recording contract. So he's got another few to do. David Kynaston is mapping Britain from Attlee to Thatcher, taking all these different sources and giving you the view that you were living in that period. The latest volume is called, I just reviewed it for the New Statesman, it's called A Northern Wind, and it covers 62 to 65. And you'll see how important the Beatles were, both in terms of, you know, here's four working class kids, two particularly, McCartney and Lennon, who were writing music that, you know, Leonard Bernstein said was equal to anything written by Purcell, who kind of changed the world.
Yeah.
Before it, you can read my music memoir, by the way, in my life, which says the same thing. You know, we were following us baby boomers, weren't we? Kind of Elvis Presley tribute acts, whether that was Marty Wilde or Cliff Richard or Billy Fury, they all wanted to look and sound like they spoke with American accents. And it was Tin Pan Alley songwriters. Suddenly here was this wave of musicality from the Mersey, and they were writing their own songs, and it was amazing. Changed the world.
I was driving up the M6 2 years ago. My son was 8 and he was doing the music, and he discovered the Beatles in that car that day, and it was incredible how he just said he took to them immediately, and to see the impact of this music on another generation.
I know.
I was just like, this is going to go on for, you know, that the McCartney estate is going to be going on for.
Let me tell you,
years.
Our parents and our uncles and aunties, those of us who were there at the time, all said you'd have forgotten about them by next year. They're gonna be, you know. And here we are all those years later.
28, wasn't he, McCartney, when the Beatles broke up? Young man.
1970, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got time for another wine. Now, your favourite wine of the night was the last wine, which I haven't introduced, actually. So we're staying in Bordeaux. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the night, Bordeaux is famous for its sweet wine. I mean, arguably, its most famous estate, you could say, is Chateau Margaux, Mouton Rothschild, Latour. This is L'Epiphanie de Sauternes. So Sauternes is a wine where they let the grapes, let them hang on the vines. And there's a sort of stream, well, let's call it a river, that runs through it called the Ciron. And before it gets to Sauternes, it goes through a pine forest. So it cools down. And then when it hits Sauternes, it warms up again. So you get these wonderful morning fogs. And if you go there in September, it's an Instagram's delight. It's hauntingly beautiful. And this fog just hugs the vines And that allows the grapes, sort of exacerbates them to sort of shrivel up and rot, and they get some what's called botrytis, and that gives it this unctuous character. It's wonderful, isn't it? And I always think Sauternes is the easiest wine to, you know, if you want to play that sort of game of naming aromas, you've got sort of honey and apricot. This has got tangerine peel, marmalade.
I love Sauternes, and I love this even better, but it's not catching on as quickly as some of the other wines. Mm. So, you know, when people started drinking stuff like Peace Porter and the German Hocks, that started a trend. People have moved off that. People are into Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, and all of that. Not quite into dessert wines yet.
No,
whereas I only have desserts to have a dessert wine.
I mean, there are a handful of wines that are just phenomenal value. Côte du Rhône, but the ones that are really underappreciated, but sommeliers and wine critics love them, are sweet wines, sherry, and fortified wines like port. And port is criminally undervalued. I mean, you can go into any sort of high street shop and you can buy a decent port for, you know, under £15 when it should be three times as much as that. But yeah, I always think if you pull out a pudding wine, everyone goes, ooh, a pudding wine. And they never quite know when to serve it. I actually like it as a pudding, or if you're feeling very decadent, especially during that sort of period between Christmas and New Year, you can have it sort of with afternoon tea with a bit of Madeira cake, something like that. Very nice. Always have it chilled. Can we have a big round of applause for Alan Johnson, who has made it so easy? It would be wonderful.
Cheers.
Thank you.
That's it from us today. Thank you very much for listening to this bonus episode of Wine Times in association with the Sunday Times Wine Club. The producer is Callum McRae and the series producer is Anya Pierce. Make sure you hit that follow button wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope to see you soon for more Wine Times.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.